Well, hello, and welcome to another episode of Overthoughts. I'm Jorge Castellanos, and I'm here with Ben Helms and Jason Helms. And today, we're going to talk about the original Blade Runner. You up for this, boys?
Oh, yeah.
Woo!
Yeah.
Woo-hoo. Oh, man. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. I'm so excited.
Yeah, definitely. Grew up on this film. I think the last time I saw it, though, was with you guys, Jorge, in your place.
Really? That long ago?
10 or 15 years ago. I think I was in high school, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just gotten Jason the, I don't think it was the, was it the final cut version?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay, so it must have been when that came out. They came out like a big briefcase, deluxe version. Yep. I think I got Jason for Christmas.
Right.
And we sat down and we watched the final cut all together. But it's been a while.
That's definitely the last time I saw it, too, so.
Yeah, but the briefcase has a little matchbox flying car in it, and it's got a plastic origami unicorn.
What?
I mean, it's pretty great. Oh, yeah.
That's
spoiler
cool.
Alert.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah. By the way, no spoiler alert in this episode. We assume you've seen Blade Runner if you're listening to this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you haven't seen Blade Runner, you know, try to see all five versions or all seven versions.
Definitely.
Or all however many versions there are out there.
Definitely. Yeah, there's a whole Wikipedia page dedicated just to the different versionings, the different iterations of Blade Runner. So feel free to check that out as well if you've only seen one or you're not sure which one you've seen. Let's start. We should probably start before the film, actually, right, with Philip K. Dick, Jay?
Sure, happy to. So Philip K. Dick was my favorite writer when I was in high school. One of the reasons that Blade Runner is one of my favorite movies. Total nerd. Philip K. Dick wrote sci-fi. He wrote really, really weird sci-fi, and I'm not sure if he holds the record for this, but he's likely to be the sci-fi author from the 20th century who has the most movies adapted from his works.
Wow.
Just tons and tons of movies. And so I'm not going to get into all the title, but Total Recall is there. They did that one twice, so boom, that's two right there.
Nice.
Well, and his style's so visual, so it really lends itself to film, you know?
Yeah, yeah. He creates worlds. And I think that's...
Really quickly, because a lot of them are based off short stories, too.
They are. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Total Recall is based off a short story, like 8 pages long.
Yeah.
Which is why you get, you know, some more time for Arnold to just chew the scenery.
I love it.
You got to fill that out.
Just act, man.
So the two biggest things that I think... Blade Runner pulls from the novel, and the title of the novel is Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Turns out they do, by the way. That's covered in page 187, the Ace edition. No, jokes.
There's different editions of that, too? Jeez.
The two, there actually are. I won't get into it. Nerding out.
Don't
sorry.
Do it. Don't do it.
The two things taken most from the novel are kind of the world, that dystopic world that's created, and that the movie is very, very faithful to.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the plot the movie has very little to do with in some ways, and even the character of Rick Deckard, very little to do with. But the second thing that it takes away are the two kind of fundamental questions. And these are the fundamental questions of Philip K. Dick's entire work, but they really crystallize in Blade Runner well. And it's what is human and what is real? Those are the two questions that he is obsessed with. He has an entire book that turns out the ending is you've been dead all along. And someone is communicating with you through a seance. And the protagonist has actually been dead through the entire thing, even though he thought he was talking to other people who were dead. So that gives you an idea of kind of how far out his plots get. Blade Runner makes a little bit more sense than some of the other plots. I'm sorry, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which you can hear what a mouthful it is, and you can understand why they changed the title.
So is the Voight Kampff machine, which is basically like a Turing test kind of, it's the same idea, right, as a Turing test?
Yeah, it is.
Loosely, right? Is that a big part of the short story? Or the book, I should
say? Oh, it's a book. It's a novel.
Sorry. Is that a big part of the book?
From what I recall, it is.
Okay.
But it's been a while. Yeah.
Okay. It's not made up for the movie, though, at least.
And I remember it being fairly similar to it. The big differences in the book are Deckard has a wife. There's a huge part of the book that's about a cult that exists during that time, about technology. And the final image in the book, which kind of parallels the movie, is... On the way back from just reflecting on him killing all these androids, Deckard finds a toad out in the middle of the wilderness. And it's thought that all the animals are dead,
or
that toads are extinct. And he comes home to show his wife. And he's so excited that he found a real-life toad. And then, of course, she finds the serial number.
Nice.
And he's devastated. And then he says, you know what? It doesn't actually matter, and I'm glad I know, because these robotic things, they have their own little lives, too.
So it seems like... one of those rare movies that might actually be, and not like, oh, it's obviously it's, you know, with things like Jurassic Park, whatever, like it's better and more rewarding if you've read the book first, right?
Right.
But a lot of times that spoils. Like, it's almost like, this is nowhere near as good as the book. But it almost seems like the movie is like an addition to the book because it's so different. And there's so much stuff in the movie that is hinted at from the book that you almost don't get from the movie unless you've seen it four or five times, or you've read all the lore and everything. But things like the serial numbers, things like all the animals are dead, which is just kind of hinted at in the movie. If you've read the book, then you're really getting rewarded that much more because it's not trying to be the same thing. You're not disappointed when you watch the film constantly being like, oh, that's not what Deckard did in the book, or that's not what this did in the book.
Yeah.
Right.
That add up for you?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not a very faithful adaptation, which I think is kind of a good thing. For the record, Philip K. Dick died while Blade Runner was being made.
Oh,
he had seen some early screenings of it, though, dailies and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And he was really excited and thought they were doing everything right, which is amazing because he was very excited that they were totally changing the plot, too. He's like, yeah, do something different. This is great.
Oh, cool. That is cool.
That's great.
Yeah. So let's jump into just kind of story. First off, we'll get into technical stuff. We'll get into like moral of the story and substance later and all that. And how what an amazing actor Harrison Ford is. And he doesn't always play the same character. Oh, wait, he does. Never mind. But anyway.
Get off my replicant.
He's basically the president in 6 days, seven nights with Anne Heche. Okay, let's get back.
That's right.
The story. When you guys saw the unicorn, I know it's been a while. Okay, we're going to jump right to the end. When you guys saw the unicorn at the end, did you have to Google what does this mean? Or did you remember? How ingrained is this movie in you and in your movie watching soul?
I definitely remembered. I mean, I made the connection.
Okay.
You know, with that insert. And part of your questions is great, Ben, because it's hard now after so many different versions and so many different years and so many different times of rewatching all this material and reading about it to really remember my initial reaction or, you know, what did I think of not seeing the unicorn now that I've seen the unicorn and all that. I mean, it's just hard to remember what kind of visceral reaction I might have had or emotional impact it might have made on me at the initial viewing. And after reading about, you know, why it wasn't there and why it is there in the final cut, which are listeners that might not know the final cut is Ridley Scott's definitive version. So, yeah, it makes sense. And I like that it adds an element to the story that not having it in there misses a great deal, I think. I think it enriches the sort of ideas. I'm disappointed that all it does is hint at those ideas. I'm looking for a further explanation or a further sort of discussion or engagement with those ideas. But, you know, the movie is what it is, not what it isn't.
I really like the ambiguity of the ending, and not just for the sake of like, oh, it shouldn't have a happy ending, right? Oh, there needs to be more ambiguity. It's not that. It's because of that central question of what is real, what is human. If the movie solves that and tells you whether or not Deckard is an android, which is the question that the unicorn raises, right?
Right.
I think it answers it.
I think it raises it.
Okay.
Because remember, he also made a little stick figure with a dong, and he made a chicken. Those were clearly just poking fun at Deckard.
But not something that only Deckard had had a dream about.
Right. It could absolutely be a coincidence, right? It could be, he says to her, or he says to Deckard, Gaff says to Deckard, too bad she won't live, then again, who does? And that's the idea of something short-lived, something mythical. Mm-hmm. All right, that could line up with a unicorn for him. That could be his expression there that he chooses a unicorn. Now, I choose to believe that Deckard's an android. I'm fine with that.
Okay.
But if the movie solves it, if it explores it too much further, then we're left with our answer of, oh, he's not real. Oh, okay, he's actually just an android. And that just there is the thing that I think they want us to linger over. Of we really can't know the difference between what's human, what's not, what's real, what's not. And because of that ambiguity on rewatches, the entire movie takes on a new dimension. Particularly, and I think we should talk about this, the love scene between him and Rachel. The scene of what I would call sexual assault.
Yeah.
It also gets reflected back in Zora talking about, has she ever been exploited? You know, she's performing sexual acts on a stage. And Deckard is asking her if she's ever felt exploited.
Right.
She's a machine. She can't be exploited.
Yeah.
Right. Rachel's a machine. She can't be sexually assaulted, but we should also realize that would make us really uncomfortable too.
Right.
Well, and I'm going to take issue with the definition of them as machines.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And androids. I don't think those are apt terms. I mean, I think the film uses the term replicant, which, you know, is sort of a wholly new label. And I think that's more apt because, you know, okay, they're humans created in a lab, but with enhanced capacities that aren't mechanical necessarily. They're just physically enhanced, right? So if you cut them, they bleed. If you dissect them, they'd look like the rest of us humans. They're just stronger and, you know, their hands don't burn when you put them in boiling water and they don't freeze when you stick them in dry ice or whatever. But they're not machines like Data's a machine in Star Trek or
C-3PO
or any of the other droid-ish characters we've seen in other films.
Yeah.
And I think that humanness, that core humanness, is really fundamental to the questions about what is human that the film wants to explore and that are explored in the book too. So
yeah, there's the scene where Roy Batty says to Pris, or they're talking to J.F. Sebastian, and Pris says, "I think, therefore I am." And Roy Batty says, "Good, now show him why." And she does a backflip.
Yeah.
And that just seems like meaningless, you know, BS, like, oh, look how philosophical we're being. Right. But this is the central question of 20th century philosophy. Is I think, therefore I am, right? Is that what we are? We are, if we were just a brain in a jar, we would still be able to think and we would therefore still exist. 20th century philosophy, anti-Cartesian philosophy, answers with no, you have a body. That is part of what it means to think. You cannot be human without having a body. And so that's why she does a backflip there. And there she's just like name checking Heidegger and all kinds of other people along the way in her backflip. So it is silly and fun, but it's also that real question of that they're more human than Data. They're not a computer, which is what Roy also says. We're not computers. We're physical.
Yeah, that's right.
The film plays so much with, is this real? Is this fake? And obviously it's a movie that is a fake thing portraying to be a real universe. So even on that meta level, that's what it's doing. And I kept going back to what I've always thought about the movie, which is it's so freaking weird, you guys. Like, the movie is so weird. And I know Total Recall, Demolition Man, I don't know why that came. I'm just trying to think of, like, weird futures that are, like, 20 to 30 years ahead of where we are now. Like, they're all a little weird, right? Because whatever, it's sci-fi and it can do that. But the movie is so specifically unique and so specifically weird that it makes it that much more real.
Yeah.
It's not just like everyone has blue hair because that's weird, but it's like, no, she wears a wig because that's what a crazy person might do in that situation, or I use that term loosely, or J.F. Sebastian, J.R. Sebastian, what's his name?
J.F.
J.F. Sebastian's, his whole like aura and like melange of style and design is so creepy and weird, but so specific that it's something that like a quickly aging, like biological designing hermit genius might actually cultivate for himself in his apartment or his mansion, whatever that the Bradbury building is. And like Roy Batty taking off his clothes at the end when he's chasing Deckard.
Yeah.
Like that's just, and like howling terrifyingly before he ends up saving Deckard's life at the end too. They're all things that are so weird. It's something that a crazy person might do in that situation because it's so specific. Mm-hmm. So it's not just weird for the sake of being weird. It tells you something about that character and that situation, which I kept trying to find these weird, I kept looking for these kind of subjective, arbitrary weirdness, but I kept finding very specific ones as I was looking
for them,
which is a universe that's very well built, both by
Ridley Scott.
Thank you. By Ridley Scott and also by Philip K. Dick. But yeah, and then back to the unicorn real quick. When he picks up the unicorn at the end, Deckard does, he gives a nod. And yeah, I don't know if the commentary kind of ruins the interpretation, but after that kind of cemented it for me, listening to Scott's commentary, which was he nods at the end, Deckard does, as he's looking at the unicorn, which could be read, I guess, to like, oh, I'm going to run away with her. Or as Scott thinks it is, or says it is I'm nodding in agreement that I finally realized I'm a replicant. Like all the things that I've been thinking my whole life as I'm chasing down these replicants, killing them, and I'm always have this hunch that I'm killing my own kind. This is finally the thing that I'm like, yep, this is it. And now I'm running away with her to get out of here because we're both replicants.
Yeah, there's so many great ambiguities like that. When he first meets Rachel, she says, "Have you ever retired a human?"
Yeah.
By mistake. Says no. And she says, "Well, that is a, a hazard of your job, isn't it? And then Tyrell walks in and says, is this to be an empathy test?
Yeah.
And it,
so good.
The question here is, who's he asking?
Right.
Rachel is performing her own Voight Kampff test on Deckard in that moment. She's conducting a little bit of, okay, what's it like to be human? Because he's doing a job that is a pretty inhuman job. Yep. He's killing people or things that look as much like people to be people. She's asking him how he could do that. And then he turns around and performs the empathy test on her, which she fails.
100 questions or so in. Yeah.
Yeah.
I realized about halfway through too, what an interesting point of view the film gives you. When I flipped it, and I try to do this in films just to kind of find out different perspectives. I'm like, what if the whole film was from this character's perspective? Would this be a good film? Would it be interesting? And that kind of gives me a better idea of is this character fleshed out? Is there a, realistic character? And one of the ones I realized during this film was if this film is from one of the four replicants that's being chased, it's from their perspective, then it's a film about oppressed people escaping from their oppression and being hunted down by a murderous bounty hunter. Otherwise, they're good, right? They haven't done something bad to be chased down by. The wrong thing is that they were created. That's the thing they did wrong before he murders Tyrell, I guess.
And they keep begging him to have empathy for them and say it's a terrible thing to live in fear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they did take some actions off world.
You're right. They did kill 23 people.
Were criminal.
Yeah, that's true.
But you could argue that those actions were in resistance to their oppression.
Exactly.
And their enslavement.
Right.
So there may be, I don't know if the right term is justification, but rationale at least.
And that's the thing is if we made a movie about that, it would be easy to write that into. That was part of their escape, right? That was, they were killing their oppressors.
And I'm one of the things that sticks with me most powerfully throughout the entire film is this notion of, I think we learn early, I don't remember what scene it is, but we learn early in where the film explains what replicants are, is that these four, at least, if not more, are over the course of time learning or growing in their capacity to feel emotions and to become what I think you can argue is more human. So they start out as sort of more lab experiments, and then they evolve over the course of their four-year life into something that's closer to human when they terminate. And, like Jason said, Roy continues to remind us of that over time in some of the things that he says. And that continues to strike with me or stick with me is this notion that, Deckard's going after these replicants that are becoming more and more human the longer they're existing.
Yeah.
To the tragic end of their existence when they're closer to being more human than they've ever been. And I find that irony, touching and intriguing at the same time.
Yeah, Ben. I like your idea of switching the perspective there, because if you shift the perspective a bit, and notably they did murder an entire, ship full of people. Of course, I've seen that movie too, and it's called The Amistad.
Right. Thank you. A ship of people.
So just a minor shift, and all of a sudden, they can be the heroes.
Yeah.
But that's not quite the tack this movie takes.
Right.
It just invites you to.
Yeah. Do you want to get into the scene?
Yeah, let's do it.
So, yeah, there's a love scene that I think, that I use that term very loosely. It's sexual assault, but it is something that I think has aged the worst out of every facet of this movie. I think the acting holds up. I mean, it's 35 years old now. Acting doesn't seem aged. The sets don't seem aged. The graphics, all the blue screen, green screen, whatever it was, like the physical models, I think they all hold up beautifully. Some of those models of the building, they look like CGI. In my mind, in my millennial mind of like, oh, that's a Peter Jackson CGI giant tower or whatever. But like,
right.
They look real is what I mean to say by that.
Bigatures.
They're bigatures, right? They're crazy. They look so, they look real in the sense that they don't look like real models. They look like real giant structures. But going back, to the scene, I don't know how this played in 1982, but now that definitely plays as a very non-consensual, aggressive rape scene.
Yeah. And it was already old in the sense that it's one of the most kind of outright nods to noir as a genre.
Of the film.
Stylistically, the noir style is throughout the film, but that scene, that's the quote unquote love scene that you're used to in a Raymond Chandler book.
Is it?
What happened there? I'm not sure I like my protagonist all that much.
And unfortunately, we've gotten the Jamie and Cersei scene from season four, right. five. Like, we've gotten into this kind of like bigger cultural movie and TV commentary, I guess, discussion, which is a good thing to have these open dialogues. Of drawing these lines, and it always seems kind of awkward to talk about it, especially as three guys talking about this, I guess, is also a little weird, but just because we don't have a full gamut of perspectives, I mean to say. But it did seem like there were some lines that were some dialogue lines that could have been said to make it consensual and to make the end, at the very end, which when he says, "Do you love me? I love you. Do you trust me? I trust you." Those are kind of the last lines of the movie, right?
Makes no sense.
To Rachel.
Totally agree.
And that makes no sense to me.
No sense.
And I don't understand to Ridley how that lines up. Can you guys give me a perspective on that?
No.
Okay. That's just...
No. I've got no answer for that second
not,
part.
Not don't justify I, this, but justify his thinking behind it, maybe.
In a sense, I'm glad the scene's there, not for the noir reference, which, I mean, you can reference noir with cigarette smoke and Venetian blinds.
They had that voiceover in the theatrical version, too.
Right.
Another noir thing.
Yeah. Because it's back to the question of what is real, what is human.
Right.
A similar question of what is consent, that there's some ambiguity there, or there can be. And if she's just a machine, is there anything wrong with it?
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
I think we could still argue that there is, but that's the implied question for us.
I gotcha. Okay. So even to think about that, there. I guess. Yeah.
So that's the only thing I can salvage from it. I would wish that scene wasn't there. If there's any scene I could just remove from the movie, I would do that for my final cut. But Ridley's had a few chances to fix it, and he didn't.
Yeah, he has had a lot of chances. That's true.
And I guess for me, it plays less as a rape scene than just a super sexually aggressive scene.
Mm.
That by the end of that scene, you know, he keeps asking her to say, "Kiss me." And then, you know, say other things. I can't remember all the dialogue in that
scene.
Tell
me you want me. Tell me you want my hands on your body.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't think he ends up saying, "Tell me you want my hands on your body." I think she adds that.
Mm.
I think her last line is invention, is not repetition, which to me indicates consent or willing participation, if you will. Yeah, he's aggressive to start the interaction, and at some point, I can't remember if it's that scene or what it is, but you know, he makes a move to kiss her and she backs up, and then he puts his hand up to say, "Wait, I'm," or the implication being, "Wait a minute, I'm not doing anything here that I don't think you really want to do.
Mm. But that's just after he ran up and slammed the door and refused to let her out.
Yeah.
Which that's the scene that problematizes it for me. It's actually not the kind of aggressive kissing.
Yeah, it's the slamming the door.
It's the chasing her down, slamming the door in front of her, not letting her out.
It's you're a trapped person.
Yes.
Yes.
Because any consent she gives after that moment doesn't count.
Right.
She is now his slave.
Yeah.
She is now much as the replicants are. And that's the way he sees her.
Yeah, I'll buy that.
So we could talk about that scene for a long time, and I think we would just end it being just as frustrated as we are now. So we can move on. But I definitely feel like we needed to at least mention that, because that stood out to me big time. I know it did all of us.
One more thing I want to throw out about the unicorn as we shift.
Yeah.
And I know that we're probably going to shift out of the story pretty soon and get to other stuff. There's one thing we haven't talked about with the unicorn in terms of there's a fan theory about it or an idea about it.
I love it.
And the idea is this. Okay. Gaff, Edward James Olmos's character, hates Deckard throughout like the first half of the movie. Sits in the background, just glares at him, does not speak English, refuses to speak English to him.
He like hits him with his cane and stuff, yeah.
Hits him with his cane, speaks with a thick accent as though he can't speak English. And then ends the movie with this kind of begrudging respect or something that feels so unearned. Like, it feels good because, you know Deckard earned it, but like, why does Gaff care?
Right.
And he says, "You've done a man's job."
Yeah, that was a weird line.
And he throws him his gun and then says, "It's a shame she won't live, but then again, who does?"
Mm-hmm.
Statement about all of us being mortal, or maybe about Deckard in particular.
Yeah.
And then he gives him the unicorn. Okay, how does Gaff know about the unicorn? Not just, okay, Deckard's an android, but why does Gaff know that particular thing about Deckard? He looked in his files and he saw that he would have a unicorn dream.
Yeah, I think he's a detective, right? Gaff is. I mean, sure, I think he would just search into the programming behind replicants and know that he would look into his file and know that this is one of his programmed dreams. That was my understanding.
He's not just a detective, he's an injured detective.
A what?
He's a detective. He's an injured detective who can no longer do his job. So here's the theory. Deckard is Gaff. Deckard has Gaff's memories. That's why Gaff hates him. That's why Gaff knows about a dream that only Gaff would know about. A recurring dream about a unicorn. That's why Gaff, at the end, says, "You've done a man's job."
I am
that man. And I'm going to give you a head start, bro.
Dude, that's good.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Wow.
I can't claim that theory as my own, but I really like it. Because it salvages for me on one weakness of this movie, which is Edward James almost is too good for that part.
Yeah.
It's just such a small part, and he does such a great job with it.
He does.
But it's so minor.
Yeah, I've always wondered if there's a lot of what he did in the film that got left on the cutting room floor.
Yeah.
That, you know, they just decided not to show, because he is such an amazing actor, and, you know, in the brief scenes that he's in, there's such a power in how he realizes that character, that you just long for more Gaff. But it is intriguing to wonder why he's so aggressively hostile to Deckard. Everything that comes off the screen that Ridley shows us doesn't give us a whole lot of clues as to backstory between them, as the backstory of Deckard's involvement on the Force as a detective, as a Blade Runner. I mean, we start the movie and he's quit, right?
He's twice as quit as when he walked in.
Yeah.
I love that line.
I'm twice as quit now.
So
I was quit when I walked in. I'm twice as quit now. Go on.
We don't know what happened to Gaff to give him the limp. We don't know what happened between them have the animosity that he shows towards Deckard. We don't know. And I don't really get a sense, like you say, Jason, of what makes him change from that level of aggression to how he is at the end of the film with Deckard. That sort of, you know, reluctant acceptance or encouragement or wise sensei-ness, or I don't know what. But so the fan theory is intriguing to me. But, you know, fan theories are fan theories. You know, it's better to talk about, from my perspective, it's better to talk about what we were shown and what can we deduce from what we're shown.
So there's the artist, the audience, and the art itself, right? Kind of the three. This is what I've been taught as far as filmmaking specifically, but any art could be used to, you know, in this kind of triangle of the weight of these three things, and how you weigh each of the three of them determines your perspective and the worth of the art, I guess, or how you see the art.
Yeah.
And so, Jorge, you would value the artist or the art more than you would the audience?
Probably the art more.
The art itself.
The art. You'd hold the art objectively as much as possible, more so than you would any commentary that would address that art or any Reddit thread that would address the art.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly am always intrigued by commentary and people's perspective on how the art impacts them, because that's all I have is how does the art impact me?
Sure.
I am the audience. But I understand that, you know, how it impacts you, how it impacts me, how it impacts anyone is at minor, subtly different, if not radically different.
Yeah.
And that's completely valid and completely, you know, is part of how the art is received. Art just doesn't exist on its own. Mm-hmm. You have to have an audience for art to sort of have an impact. But I'd rather rely on, you know, especially with a film, with the film medium, it's about what you're shown more than it is about what you're not shown. I mean, we can argue that in specific instances and specific films. And, you know, I'm not going to hold hard and fast to that. But in general, I have to base my notions on what the artist is showing me in the art.
Yeah.
Let's link that to one moment in the film.
Do it.
Which I think we can talk about all three there. It's an interesting moment. It's the Tears in Rain speech that Roy Batty gives at the end.
Yeah.
Beautiful. And do you guys know who wrote that speech?
No.
Rutger Hauer, the night before he performed it.
All of those moments will be lost.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll get both in there. Don't worry.
But, okay, sorry.
I will read in a moment the original speech, and you will see why he rewrote it.
By the way, real quick, Rutger Hauer showed up to his audition already bleaching platinum his hair, wearing red contacts and bright, I think, pink or orange leather pants.
So good. He's so good.
When he met Ridley, and Ridley was just like, who the hell is this crazy person? I do not want him in the film.
The original hobo with a shotgun, Rutger Hauer.
And he was in the film later that day.
I actually hear that Rutger Hauer is Daniel Day-Lewis, but
yes,
just gone way method.
He's just running around in his boxer briefs around LA.
Way method. Yeah.
Sorry, had to go.
All right, so I'll give you the original speech before we get to, and then Ben, you can play the clip of the finished one.
Cool.
And I will try to read it in my best Rutger Hauer as I can.
Yeah. Sometimes American, sometimes German, sometimes who knows what he is.
Who knows? Yeah. Rutger Hauer transcends all borders.
All cultures.
So this is the speech as was originally written.
As written.
Okay.
And then he rewrote it and improvised and finally got it to how he liked it and then delivered it that day. And people did not know it was coming, and people cried when he actually did his improvised version.
Who knows if they actually cried? Because it was raining, though.
Good, because it was raining. It was raining.
I have known adventures, seen places you people will never see. I've been off-world and back. Frontiers. I've stood on the back deck of a blinker bound for the Plutician camps with sweat in my eyes, watching the stars fight on the shoulder of Orion. I've felt wind in my hair riding test boats off the black galaxies and seen an attack fleet burn like a match and disappear. I've seen it. Felt it!
Yup, that sucks.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's not as good.
Please play now.
Yes, the actual version. Got it. Will do.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain. Time to die.
Oh, man. And then you have lines like, "We need you, Sebastian. You're our best and only friend.
You're our best and only friend."
Daryl Hannah's the best.
Okay. We don't like that line, but he's already said twice, "My toys are my friends. Yeah. I made them."
Yeah.
He's looking for companionship.
There's at least another level there.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So the reason I wanted to pull that one up is you've got the artist, you've got the art itself, and you've got the audience. The artist here not being Ridley Scott, but being Rutger Hauer. Indirectly, Ridley for pulling them in, for putting this whole thing together. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the art itself, the tears in the rain speech that shows up, and the audience. Not only does that stand out as, I think, one of the most important moments in the film, but certainly the most influential. I've seen that parodied and referenced in I don't know how many films and TV shows. It's got a resonance all its own and has had a life beyond the film.
Yeah.
Well, and a critical speech to see what kind of effect it has on Deckard there on the roof.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm reading into it, but for me, Deckard's perspective expands on who replicants are or can be, or, you know, I think I don't know that he questions his role at that point of replicant hunter, but he certainly is confronted with much more than just a theoretical human. He's hearing from a guy that is poetic in front of him, and That's a level of depth of humanity that maybe he hasn't accounted for yet. So really critical in how he continues to think about Rachel after that.
Which brings me to my primary theme or motif maybe of the film, which is basically accelerated decrepitude, or also known as life short, then you die.
Right.
Which she, you know, Daryl Hannah mentions that the replicants each talk about time to die and they only live 4 years. And we have all of these moments will be lost. Like you said, like the Roy scene, Gaff says, like we mentioned again, it's too bad she won't live, but then again, who does? Then we have the idea of the unicorn, which is this sacred, or not sacred, this the idea of a unicorn is it's a very special one-time, once-in-a-life occurrence, but really it's not a real thing. So both of those ideas of like life is so rare and special and so short, but really in this film we're also talking about the fact that it's not real. It's not real life.
Right.
These are fake people.
Right.
Because I love all of those layers together, and just the phrase accelerated decrepitude was one of my favorite lines of the whole film too.
Yeah. Let's match it with the idea of planned obsolescence, which would be just starting to come into style when Dick is writing this.
I just got my iPhone 8, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly. you need something new. And that's what Philip K. Dick's novel is all about. It's about the encroaching of technology into our lives.
Yeah.
Until the concern isn't that there will be too much technology, but that we will no longer be human. And the question is, at what point do we cross that? Not when robots are here, but when I need an iPhone 10. Or a 12, or yeah. You know, at what point am I no longer being me? And I think a lot of his answer is just, it's not, you know, oh, you should go out and be a hippie in the woods. But just, no, to be human is always to embrace technology. So it will be redefining humanity to some extent.
Yeah. When they introduce all the replicants, they, you know, you kind of see their files, and I think they're talking to, the police chief is talking to Deckard about it. He says, he introduces Del Hanna's character. He says, standard pleasure model. I was like, oh, that'll be interesting. They'll do some sort of commentary on how culture views women as these kind of objects and these, you know, they're designed to be kind of these disposable things that we all use. And then they have like the cage dancing strippers. They have the snake dildo show, whatever it was. Like they have all these things that I'm like, oh, this is going to be an interesting commentary. And then they have the sexual assault scene. And I'm just like, I don't know if they're letting like, I don't know if that's exactly what Ridley Scott's going for. That's what I'm taking away. But I don't think most people seeing this film are like, yeah, these are the negative effects of viewing women as objects. As much as they kind of beat that into you in the first half hour, where it's like, oh, these like aggressive, like standard pleasure model. As soon as they said that, I was like, wow, that's pretty in your face. Like, all right.
Yeah, you want the interpretive key there to help you make that connection.
Thank you.
Oh, yes. Okay. All these, we're dehumanizing people. And the way that we treat particularly women in our culture is dehumanizing.
Right.
That would be a great moment to have in this movie. I'd love to say it's on the cutting room floor, but again, Ridley's had a couple shots at this.
Yeah. We'll have a final cut in 25 more years, maybe.
Please, God, no.
And that just thinking about those scenes where Harrison Ford, some of the first in the first half hour again of him going around like the farmers market areas, the different shops and stuff, and talking to the owners and ordering four noodles. Oh, two noodles? No, four noodles. And just all of those like
four.
Miscommunication. I love frustrated Harrison Ford. Maybe more than any actor in any emotional set in my life. Frustrated Harrison Ford is so great. He adds so much more to the page than there actually is just by being frustrated.
It's his natural habitat.
Frustrated Han Solo. Frustrated Indiana Jones. It's amazing.
It's where he lives.
And falling over things, clumsy. One of the, I'm just going to keep talking over you guys.
Please.
One more thing on clumsy Harrison Ford. Right before the scene we talked about earlier when he's napping and Rachel's playing piano, he has a drink on the edge of the couch. Did you guys catch this?
Go on.
He wakes up. He wakes up
and drops
knocks
it,
the drink over.
Catches it.
And catches it.
Yeah.
Which is something you'd think maybe only a robot could do because it's very quick.
Yeah.
But again, clumsy Harrison Ford. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, and speaking of Harrison Ford, I think I've got a quote for you guys that might kind of wrap up this segment and lead us into a next one.
Sure.
You know, I'm reading off the Blade Runner version's wiki page, and It says that in 2000 he gave a view on the director's cut of the film, saying that he thought it was spectacular, but it didn't move him at all. Mm. And the reason for that is quote, they haven't put anything in, so it's still an exercise in design. Some of that resonates for me. You know, this film, although it has some amazing things, ideas, notions, which we've outlined here so far, that really come from the book and then evolve in a different kind of way in the film, that are really worth wrestling with and that are big ideas and big questions in life. You know, for me, the thing that sticks with me is the design of the film, the visual design of the film.
Yeah.
And you guys both talked about how I think, Ben, you said how the look and so much of it still holds up. I mean, I said that to myself 2 minutes into rewatching it the other day when I was getting ready for this podcast. It was like, wow, this thing really holds up still.
Totally.
And the world building that Dick does in so much of his work is just so well realized in this film. I mean, you just get a visceral sense of what this LA 2019 dystopian future is feeling like. Is you can almost smell the place. I mean, it's just so well detailed in all that stuff. In all the bizarreness of, you know, he's walking around, you know, about to get that food or just after having bought it or whatever, he's on the street level and there's, you know, ostriches walking by.
Yeah.
It's just just bizarre. With so many different ethnicities and so much different sounding language. I couldn't tell if it's one language or a melange of that languages. And even the one language that Gaff will only speak seems to be some sort of conglomerate of a different previous languages. And all of that, I just think, is just spectacular. And the thing that just hits me most about the film over and over again after all these years is just, this world that they built is just so rich and so great, you know, in a way that the cantina film in Star Wars isn't, or the cantina scene, right? I mean, that seems more cheesy, more sort of kitsch, if you will. And this one seems so real and gritty and raw.
And one of the ways I think they do that is the grittiness. It's the broke down future aesthetic that Alien had as well. Star Wars has to some extent. And can't quite decide on.
Episode one does not have.
Yeah. And the layering that they do on the city of Los Angeles is, I think, what makes it most effective. Taking the Bradbury building, right, and just layering it on. I think it's the Third Street Tunnel, right? And nothing has changed about it. It's still just a tunnel that goes through LA. We just have a flying car that goes through it now, or a futuristic car.
Yeah.
Little things like that. I think that they did the layering really nice. They took what already existed and just imagined 40 years on top of it.
I think I wish we had Dom here for this, but maybe he can touch on this when you guys do the sequel or the 2049 episode that we'll do as well. But the visual style and the lens movements, things like lens flares that were out of style for the first 40 years of film, came into style for a few years in the 80s, and then went out of style again in the 90s. And in the 2000s, we started getting digital and we started getting better lenses and better technology to shoot films. Then came back into style 10 years or so ago with Whedon, J.J. Abrams, Michael Bay, just crazy lens flares, crazy 360 camera movements and stuff like that. This is a much, much more subtle version of the Michael Bay shooting, I guess, but helped kind of invent modern film in a lot of ways, and a lot of the subtle camera movements and a lot of, I guess, technical ways that, again, Dom can speak to more than I can. But just in kind of more obvious ways that I noticed in watching it that went away for 25 years and came back recently. I think makes it a perfect time, hopefully, for a sequel. And I'm probably doing this segue too soon because we're not going to talk about the sequel yet. But yeah, it didn't seem aged, even in the way it was framed, the costume designs. It didn't seem like, oh, this is 1982. It seemed like a modern film set in a dystopian future to me.
It wasn't until I rewatched the film for this podcast that I noticed that, oh, Douglas Trumbull did the visual effects here. He also did the visual effects for Close Encounters. Mm-hmm. And wow, all those flying cars or whatever they are, they sure look and move and are lit alike like all the spaceships in Close Encounters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, and I made that connection and I thought, well, that's cool because, you know, Close Encounters, the aliens are sort of treated differently. The fact of them in spaceships is treated differently. That whole setting is different. And here we are in a dystopian future and we're still seeing the same kind of movement, but in a different context. And it totally worked for me.
And great art. And we talked about what we want to weigh more, artist, art, or audience, but great art can be dissected from almost an endless amount of angles, right? Can be analyzed and analyzed and analyzed. And at least that's one of my definitions of great art personally, is that you can always go back and find more, with every time you experience it again, with movies, every time you watch it, you can get more and more out of it. And one of the things I got this time was the replicant eyes, which was that like cat-like or deer animal eyes, right? That reflection, that soft glow in the pupil. that I noticed before, but I didn't realize it was every single replicant had until this watch. And looked into about how they did it, and there's this great technical story I'll link to in the show notes about how he was able to specifically do that. But I thought that was interesting how that never happened with Deckard as well. I don't know if that's a wink wink or, again, just keep leaving it ambiguous, but just fascinating things like that, that you don't have to notice it to be a good movie. But if you do notice it, it makes it that much better of a movie. There's so many things like that in this film.
Well, and there's also stuff, I mean, you're talking about the eyes, you know, there's an extras feature on the 5-disc, a Blu-ray issue that it talks about all the different versions and what they went through in order to get the final cut to where they needed to get to and how they found all the film and what state it was in and the soundtrack and all that stuff, all those technical details. But it also talks about philosophically, they realized that there were a ton of stuff that they could redo and fix and tweak, but that some of them were at the level of just, I don't remember what the phrase they used, but it's kind of like a lovable flaw that fans had come to expect and appreciate and fall in love with, and changing them, you know, could be technically the right thing to do, but didn't, they weren't such a big flaw that it needed to have happen, like the unicorn scene or that the closing shot with the dove flying away, where that, you know, the original way they shot it was just so, you know, bad looking, if you will, that they knew that they needed to reshoot that or redo that in a way that made it look like when they looked at, when you saw the dove flying into a sky, it was the same sky that Deckard and Roy were seeing from the rooftop, not just blue sky otherwhere that shot came out of nowhere. Ridley said that originally he ran out of money and time, and that's what they had to live with. So that's not the kind of lovable flaw that this extra was talking about. But one of the things that they did talk about was a lovable flaw that had to do with eyes, was that in one scene, Gaff's eyes are blue, and in another scene, they're not.
Really?
Wow.
Does that add to the whole discussion about, is Gaff a replicant?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Weird.
But they chose to leave that one alone for whatever sake. It wasn't essential to them fixing, but it's, you know, it's a difference.
Yeah. Umberto Eco says that novels are machines for generating interpretations. I feel that way about film as well. That's why I love these fan theories. As long as we never get distracted, like you said, Jorge, from the film itself, to just think about the fan theories. I love the interpretations that these make. And that's one of the cool things about switching eyes. It's like, well, now I can make three more interpretations. Yeah. Whereas before, it was just a guy.
Yeah, exactly.
So one more question I have that maybe is a question for our audience as we make this art as the artist. I don't know. But is when he's looking at the photo, when Deckard's looking at the photo, did you guys catch this? Where he goes, enhance, 224 to 176. Enhance, 324 to 476, or whatever it is. Did Blade Runner invent enhance?
I think it did.
It's been the staple of every police procedural TV show the last 20, 30 years.
It may have. That's a good question.
That was getting to the point of ridiculous.
Well,
right?
I think of it in the context of other sci-fi that we've seen, not so much police procedurals. Oh, okay. But what other sci-fi have we seen? I know they use that sort of enhanced thing in Star Trek.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
probably not until the Next Generation. I don't know that they did it in the original Star Trek. And it probably occurs in a bunch of sci-fi film since Blade Runner, but I don't know about it occurring before that.
Well, I know, like, it reminded me of all of those, like, CSI and random things until he started moving the photo around and objects in the photo. Oh, and then I was like, oh, this is more like Minority Report, where it's just like cameras everywhere and they can see everything all the time and they know what's happening. I was like, okay, this is a little... It's bending my willing suspension of disbelief a little bit there. And I came back immediately as soon as the scene was over, but it's a little goofy. Anything else from the film you guys wanted to touch on?
Well, we haven't talked about the score. Vangelis!
Oh, bring it.
Vangelis. Okay, so this film was released in 1982, the original Blade Runner, with the Vangelis score. The previous year, 1981, is when Chariots of Fire was released, which is the signature Vangelis score. I mean, that's really the film that sort of debuted him as a composer in a lot of ways. Not technically debuted, but really the big splash where everybody noticed, oh, wow, Vangelis and this score and all that. Mm-hmm. And then sort of after Blade Runner, that was his peak, man. Those two films, Chariots and Blade Runner. And then he did other stuff, but never with as much gravitas as he showed in these two films. So, and I, even though viewing it now and listening to it now, the Vangelis score can sound a little dated because it is electronic music. And so, you know, that sort of gives you a sense of
so many synths.
To me, electronic music always says 80s, but it still works.
Kind of like Peter Gabriel. So
it still works really, really, really well. Yeah, actually, kind of like that. And in watching, it still feels of a piece to the material in the film. And it doesn't stick out as cheesy or inappropriate or dated in a sort of a taking away from what the film's power is. It still seems perfect for what the film is. And I love it.
Two things I'd love to say about the Vangelis score. First off, it sounds nothing like Chariots of Fire, which is amazing. I mean, they sound like they were made by different human beings, not someone at a different point in his career where it was just a few years later. But like, I can't believe the same mind came up with both of those. And the second is, yeah, I'm with you that the synth feels dated. It never does in Blade Runner for me because it never felt like the 80s to me. It never felt natural. It didn't sound like 80s synth. It just sounded like an alien had made it. It sounded like music from the future. I felt like he was very much playing a score from 2019.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I remember distinctly noticing in this latest viewing that there were parts of that score that were more like sound design than I had remembered. There's some segments where you're listening to a heartbeat in the score. That's totally perfect for what you're seeing on screen. And it reminded me of what we talked about with the score for Dunkirk, where so much of that was about creating an atmosphere of emotional experience. So, yeah, I agree with you, Jade. I think it totally works.
Speaking of sound design, the Foley work when Leon hits Deckard was so good because all he's doing is slapping him and moving his hand like 6 inches.
Yeah.
And if they just play a slap sound effect, it would be so silly.
It would be sound a pat. Like
nothing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Deckard just moves his hand. But the way they do this, the sound effect, it sounds like a freight train hit him with every slap. And it's so subtle and it's so effective.
And it has that physical effect on Deckard, right?
Yeah. I mean, it
looks like he's gotten hit by a freight train.
Yeah.
And the blood and whatever, you know, he's beat
the
up.
Blood and the vodka. When he has a sip of vodka and the blood just pulls
that's
out.
Great.
Such a great.
I look
Such
forward to that shot. Scene every time.
Oh, it's so good.
Injured Harrison Ford, man. It's the best.
It really is. That's why he keeps crashing his planes. He knows.
Three different times. The man has crashed his plane three times, guys.
Well.
Maybe he's not acting, guys. Can we talk about that? He's not an actor. Gosh. All right. We should get back to this.
Guys, I get to see Blade Runner 2049 tonight.
Nice.
I am so excited.
You're doing the midnight showing for old people that's actually at like 6 p.m. or whatever?
Yeah, they don't do midnight shows anymore. They do them at normal times because midnight showings are terrible.
I think high schoolers still do midnight showings.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah,
I'm going to the Alamo Drafthouse. Nice. We're not sponsored by the Alamo Drafthouse, but we will take your money, Alamo Drafthouse.
That's true. And we'll still give you our money.
Yeah, we'll still give you our money. We can just trade monies.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited. One question that Ben came up with earlier I'd love to talk about is, what movie is this the sequel to? Because there's five versions of Blade Runner. Seven versions? 12? What did we get up to? Five,
I don't know,
I think.
Man.
Five to seven, depending on who's
I'd say most people who've seen Blade Runner have seen at least two versions and probably three. Yeah. How about that?
Let's stick with it. Just a conversation about final cut versus theatrical cut. And view those as the two versions. Which of these two do you think we're seeing a sequel to?
I would have to believe we're seeing a sequel to the final cut.
Yeah.
Because the final cut is Ridley Scott's definitive, hands-on reworking of what he thought the film ought to be. And since he's involved in 2049, I can't imagine he'd allow 2049 to sort of pick up where the theatrical release left off, if you will. And even if they don't go that specifically where it's just like, oh, the next moment or the next day or whatever, the ambiguity he wanted to preserve with the final cut ending versus the original theatrical cut ending, I think is what we have to take into the next film.
Ben?
Yeah, I want to add to that, but I 100% agree. Yeah, I mean, I'm selfish because I just watched that version. But he fixed up so much stuff that he didn't like about the original. It would make sense that they would go off of this one. And my guess is that there won't be things that if you'd only seen the theatrical version, you won't be like confused halfway through the movie and be like, wait, what's Harrison Ford doing? Why is he acting like this or whatever? Like, I don't think it's going to be that tied to the plot and story and characters of the original.
Yeah, I think since the major differences are just how the ending feels,
yeah,
it kind of doesn't matter in the sense that
that's true too.
This movie can be like, and then Rachel died 2 seconds after that ending.
Yeah,
and with the final cut, you're like, yeah, I kind of saw that coming. And the theatrical cut, you're like, what? No way, man. Aw.
Right.
But it still works.
Yeah.
So I think the real question about the sequelness is, does Ryan Gosling give a voiceover?
Noir the whole time.
I would think not.
What's it the spiritual sequel to?
Drive in Space.
Yeah.
It's a sequel to Drive.
It's a sequel to Drive. Absolutely.
That's what we all wanted.
Sequel to Drive.
Oh, guys.
Or does he sing the entire movie?
Oh, gosh.
Los Angeles, 2049. That's the opening thing.
Yeah.
We get a crawl, and then we hear, girl, as Ryan Gosling walks us into, girl, let me tell you what it's like to hunt replicants down.
I guess what I'm most intrigued about experiencing about the new film is what's happened in 30 years. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What's happened to the world? 30 years is a significant amount of time.
The Tyrell Corporation.
Yeah. Tyrell Corporation doesn't have its leader any longer. What happened to that? What happened to the notion of replicants?
Yeah.
Have they been more oppressed, less oppressed? Are they integrated into society further? Are they still being hunted by Blade Runners or some 30-year later equivalent version? I mean, I'm interested in sort of those bigger picture notions.
Yeah.
Than I am about, hey, what happened to Deckard and Rachel, to be honest.
Well, and if Deckard's still around, he can't be an android. He can't be a replicant because they had 4-year lifespans.
Well, although doesn't Tyrell, when he's explaining Rachel to Deckard for the first time, says that she's an experiment. And if she's an experiment, maybe her lifetime is different.
Yep. They could yada yada that pretty quickly.
So there's a lot of ambiguity in that lifetime that, you know, I certainly buy for the 4 renegade replicants Roy was leading of a 4-year lifespan, but not necessarily for Rachel or Deckard, if he's a replicant, or any other ones in the future necessarily.
Yeah, I sort of hope that they go even bigger picture in the way that the first one, I wouldn't say failed to go, but ran out of time to go and kind of ends with this open question. We talk a lot about like, what is life? What is real? And ask those questions of the characters. I would love for it to get even more philosophical and throw that on the audience in a non-ambiguous, non-only the super nerds would ask the question, but it's almost obvious of just like, what is real life? Like, why are we here? And it gets really existential more than just a backflip. And it's tough to do that in kind of an artistic way. But I think Denis Villeneuve has shown he can do that. It's tough when you see big directors take on these big IPs because they want to be true to their art and their filmography, but they also want to be true to, especially, you know, the previous director has such big famous IP as well. So it'd be interesting to see that balance, but hopefully he takes that on himself and is able to kind of go even deeper than Ridley did in that idea of what's real versus what is false.
And Arrival was adapted from a novel, or I'm sorry, a short story Peter Chiang, I think is his name. And I read the short story. The short story is great. It's really fun. The movie, I think, is actually better. It takes some of the things in the short story that are nascent and really plays them out in nice ways so that you get to investigate them and really not just creating ambiguities, but really creating a deeper investigation of the themes that the original short story opens up.
Oh, cool.
So cool. I'm excited about that, to see how he develops some of the Blade Runner themes, to see if he goes in new directions. I'll be very disappointed if this is just a thrilling sci-fi action movie, which is all I wanted from the original Blade Runner when I first saw it.
Right.
But, right. And it was, but I think we're going to go in some new directions, and I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that too. And I rarely like to speculate about details about future films, you know, because for me, I like to stay as isolated as I can from trailers and blogs and podcasts and other things that try to predict what we're going to see or
show you the whole thing.
Give a sneak peek. Yeah. I mean, I like to be surprised by the art, not my expectation of the art.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I wonder if they're going to do in order to explore the potential humanity or evolving humanity of replicants is, what if Deckard and Rachel have a kid?
Mm.
Oh, nice.
And what if that kid?
And what does that mean?
Is Jared Leto?
And especially if they're both replicants, right? If Rachel and Deckard are replicants and they have a kid, what is that kid?
What's the kid?
Right.
Yeah.
As far as the discussion of what is human.
Yeah. What's real? Yeah.
You know, so I don't need for that detail to happen or that plot twist to go there. But that
I'd love for that to be the end of the movie. That's the twist on the movie. So you, in not ruining the movie for yourself, you've ruined the movie for every listener of this podcast. Yeah. Twist!
Spoiler alert in spades.
Whoops.
Prognostication alert.
Jorge being the one who always issues spoiler alerts, I'm just hoping that he went out and he found a review, a preview of it. And he's like, let me just drop this in.
And I'm sneaking
it in. What do you guys think? Wouldn't it be crazy? Wouldn't it be crazy if?
That'd be weird.
I've been torturing Ridley Scott here in my basement for 2 months, and I finally got him to tell me.
Nice.
Well, Ridley Scott's been torturing us for 40 years, so it's finally time for some payback.
Nice.
Jeez. And you tell me, we've talked about how many versions there are of this film, but is this the only time that we've experienced a sequel that feels like there are 14 films behind it when there's really only one?
I can't think of anything like it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It feels like this is the sixth film.
Right. It's like the Star Wars universe when The Force Awakens came out kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so.
Which is just a weird thing to experience. So
it's like the Star Wars universe, except there's just one movie.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. One other thing I'd love to mention. Totally forgot about this. In the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a video game of Blade Runner that I totally think we should do for Mulmth at some point, because it was a 5-disc adventure game where the characters changed depending on how you acted. So if you were rude in the beginning, it wasn't just those characters that would like talk differently to you. Other characters would respond differently because you would be behaving as a rude person. And there were therefore, they totaled it out, but it was like 250,000 different endings to the game or versions of the game, because you could just kind of experience the game differently. But from what I recall, you kind of go through a lot of the similar beats, and it's a very detective style adventure game with a lot of great voice acting. I'm excited about it. So I'd love to come back to that. I think I have it upstairs, actually.
Sweet, I'm in.
You remember what that's called?
I think it's just called Blade Runner.
Yeah, it's just called Blade Runner, 1997 by Westwood Studios.
Yeah, Westwood Studios. I forgot about them. Yeah. Oh, it was a great one. I really loved it. So yeah, I'd love to go back to that. All right. Well, with that and my random thing at the end, we'll say goodbye, but not for too long. Early next week sometime, maybe later next week, we will be treating you with our coverage of Blade Runner 2049. Don't worry, we will be sure to overthink it. All right, until next time, I'm Jason.
I'm Ben.
I'm Jorge.
That was weird. See you guys.